An horrific shooting during Mass at a Catholic church in Minneapolis resulted in the tragic deaths of two children and injuries of 17 others. Security expert and former NYPD officer Patrick Brosnan is here to share his perspective. The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, join me with analysis and their reaction to the Minneapolis shooting and some interesting new appointments in a major dicastery in Rome. And how is the Chinese Communist government exerting its influence in the U.S. homeland? Foreign policy expert Gordon Chang is here with an update. And how have the faithful in the Diocese of Charlotte been affected by the bishop's crackdown on the traditional Latin Mass? A spokesman for the new YouTube documentary about the situation, Bread Not Stones, is here to weigh in. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo, also at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Lots to check out there. On Wednesday, a shooter opened fire through the windows of a Minneapolis Catholic church during morning mass. Two children, ages 8 and 10, were killed. 17 others, 14 children and three elderly parishioners were wounded in what the Minneapolis chief of police called an absolutely incomprehensible act of violence. The killer was a 23-year-old male who identified as a female and took his own life on the scene. Joining me now with his unique perspective on what we know so far is security expert and former NYPD detective Patrick Brosnan. Patrick, thank you for being here. According to reports, the shooter, Robert Westman, changed his name to Robin in 2020 with his mother's approval. This incident certainly echoes the 2023 Nashville shooting at that Christian school that killed seven. Again, the shooter was transgender, and the target was a Christian institution. Your thoughts, Patrick, on the parallels, and obviously mental illness is involved here, but is this another case of indulging mental illness? I mean, even he wrote he didn't feel like a woman and knew he wasn't one.
I'll be very frank. As a detective for many years and as the owner of a security company, national company, I got to say, I really don't have any great or compelling understanding or need to understand how the transgender plays into this barbaric, savage, absolutely Neanderthal shooting that occurred yesterday with these children at the church. It was absolutely horrific. And the reality is this guy, Raymond, was a bit of a ghost. He was a phantom. He was not on any radar. He was unremarkable in all aspects. He had no criminal record. He had no mental health issues. He had no complaints from the community. He bought the guns legally. This guy is a phantom. And I hate to say it, and it pains me deeply to say this, but this mass shooting, very similar 30 days ago on Park Avenue at 345 Park, was completely unpreventable.
Really?
The speed.
But surely.
Yes, and it kills
surely
me.
There were signs, Patrick, that the family saw. People, I mean, you do have a guy wearing braids and coming out. I mean, you know, he clearly something was off here. There was an internal alienation or conflict in this person.
I don't doubt that. I mean, and the facts are beginning to support that as the data and intel and information does trickle in. But the reality is he had no history of mental health. He had no history of mental health direct problems, and he was not on the radar. And it's interesting because there's a lot of discussion right now that, well, if folks had known, he could have been under surveillance and then he went operational. This is a fallacy. That's a fable. We saw it with the Boston Marathon, with the Sarnaev brothers. They were under sustained surveillance, the older brother, the boxer, for 15 months. This is an event that occurred. And the planning and the warning signs, Raymond, the danger signs were trapped in his sick mind. And since he didn't publicly, to our knowledge, right, share it with anyone, it was unknown. It was a secret. And that secret didn't allow any mitigation. There was no way to mitigate this. And by the way, mathematics was in his corner. mathematics, he was very close. I looked at the parking lot grid. I looked at an oval. I took a look. He got from that car in about 11 seconds, almost identical to 345 Park Avenue. 11 seconds.
Amazing.
Think about it. Yeah. Who could stop him?
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Well, we're learning
it's horrific.
More and more about this. He didn't give any really advance notice, but he did release this so-called manifesto on YouTube. But that was, I believe, the day of the shooting. And there we see his drawings of the church. He was a graduate of the school. Photos of his equipment with messages like, "Where is your God?" "Kill Donald Trump." Numerous supposed grievances. Patrick, the question is, what do you make of the nature of those messages in hindsight? And talk about the planning that obviously went into this attack. He knew these grounds.
So the message is in hindsight, Raymond. Yes, they're informing because investigators are always going to want to establish motive. They want to understand how to prepare and mitigate and diminish the probability of a reoccurrence, right, through pragmatic overview. So you're going to want to know that. But the reality, from what I understand from published facts, is that release of those drawings and those hate rantings and videos were to coincide with the mass shooting. And that's my understanding. I believe that is accurate. But again, the fact that they were timed to coincide, this manifesto, this last letter, and I read it, made him a complete ghost to the law enforcement authorities because he wasn't on any radar. No one, granted, you mentioned his family would know things. Well, that's family. They didn't share it.
Yeah.
This guy was able to get out of his car, Raymond, strut with the three weapons, about 11 or 12 seconds to those stained glass windows, and unleash holy hell on little boys and girls who were reading. It shatters your heart, who were praying in this church. And the reality is, and it destroys me to say it, there was no preventing it, there was no escaping it, unless, and it's statistically improbable that there was an off-duty retired guy who was armed or an armed civilian who could engage him that quick and terminate him and take him out of his misery. What are the odds?
Patrick.
Not good.
Yeah. Westman indulged in dialogues with Satan in this manifesto. He was also a cannabis user. He worked at a dispensary. Should the drug use be a focus in this case? I mean, we do know from, you know, I had brain specialists on my podcast last week, Dr. Daniel Amen, and he said it can lead to psychosis, particularly in the young.
Well, it's interesting. I only learned recently by default that the marijuana today is about 100 times more devastating in the impact on cognitive function and other functions. I just learned that recently. So my answer is yes, it would certainly be contributory in fleshing out what we'll call the story. And the story is, Raymond, we want to know who his kindergarten teacher was and what her maiden name, and we want to know up to and including what he had for breakfast yesterday and everything in between. How was he influenced? Mm. What were the influences? Who did he speak to? Who may share complicity relative to having intelligence that they didn't share? And is that a crime in the state of Minneapolis? So that's the whole idea of the investigation, right? There's always an ocean, a tsunami of data, intel, and information to be parsed through. And that's a big element to your point. Absolutely.
You talked about preventing tragedies like this in the future. The Daily Wire is reporting that 2 years ago, Tim Benz, the president of Mindependent, which is a group of independent schools, and Jason Atkins, who's the executive director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, wrote a letter to the governor, Tim Walz, stressing an urgent and critical need in Minnesota to make sure the schools are safe and secure in light of the recent and continuing attacks. Jason Atkins, the Minnesota Catholic Conference head, said that Governor Walz did nothing. Your reaction, Patrick, and what's the answer here?
So I'm going to try, and Raymond, this is a heavy lift, to stay totally objective. Walz is clueless. No fan here. But the reality is, as the owner for 30 years of a national security company who has provided security at over 3,000 locations, armed and otherwise, across 500 cities, I know about this. I wrote with my teams mitigating policies for 75 synagogues in the greater Philly area with the same direction, the same intent, and the same concern of how to mitigate an attack. The sad reality, again, kills me to share it, is it's impossible. There's so many schools, so many synagogues, so many churches. And when And when are the, no one ever believes, and these were clients of mine. We had endless conversations. They never know, are they going to be the super unlucky one? The chances one in millions that this kind of thing would occur, this horrific act would occur. And it's not just a needle in a haystack. It's a needle in a pile of needles, given the context overall nationally, the number of buildings. So what do you do? Well, in a perfect situation, it could never happen, both economically and pragmatically, in terms of human beings available to perform that function, would be to have armed personnel, right? Yeah, put a guy with
That's
a gun,
I was gonna ask
seize the
you.
Guy with the gun.
Is that what we need? Do we need armed guards at every church? I mean, should we have retired? There's certainly a lot of Catholic, you know, ex-cops, ex-military. Certainly, you could have a volunteer squad that would stand at every church, but is that where we're headed? Is that what's needed now?
We could be headed that way, and we have had discussions. We have had a lot of client meetings regarding that, because we have had at Brosnan, at the security company, we have deployed armed personnel, sometimes two, sometimes four, during services at from synagogues to churches and other houses of worship. Absolutely. Wow. And could you do it with a volunteer force? You could, provided they were trained and armed and licensed and compliant with federal and state mandates.
Right.
But the reality is, there's so many buildings, Raymond. There's hundreds of thousands. I mean, there's only 600,000 law enforcement personnel who would even be available to. I did the math one time with Hannity, because we were trying to look at options with what we call safe rooms, but they actually are interlocking series of doors if someone were to come in and you lock them in. It's called a man trap, right? But this guy shot through the stained glass window, same way as the guy in Sandy Hook did, because we went up there, we tried to look at stuff back and when it occurred. The reality is, this type of lightning fast, unplanned, random, by an unremarkable person who's not under surveillance, who's committed and merciless. When he got to that window, he unleashed holy hell. He opened fire 100 rounds. Unpreventable. Unpreventable.
Yeah. Patrick, Pope Leo XIV was among many who expressed sadness, solidarity with the victims, saying he was profoundly saddened by this attack. FBI Director Kash Patel posted on X that the FBI is investigating this shooting as an act of domestic terrorism and hate crime targeting Catholics. Now, according to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, at least 250 incidents of vandalism, arson, property damage targeting Catholic churches and institutions have occurred across 42 states and D.C. since May of 2020. Why are we seeing this kind of hate and grievance-fueled attack, particularly targeting Catholic institutions, Patrick?
Again, and this is a bit speculative, okay? But the facts that I know, and I'm relatively cognizant of them because of the business, is that these individuals, like this person, this trans person who committed this horrific act, they get these vile vitriolic threads of hatred, whether it's for the church, as we saw, there was something for Donald Trump, there was others, I read it, I saw. And the reality is, it festers in their sick mind. And unfortunately, they generally do not share it with another human being who could perhaps see something, say something, and we could mitigate and intercede. And that's the horror show, particularly in this instance, and the same at 345 Park Avenue. So it festers, it builds, and then they go operational. And there's no rhyme or reason to it. There's no rhyme. There's no special date. It's not, you know, like 9/11, you're doing it because of some reason, or Christmas morning, or St. Patrick's Day, the high holy day. There's no specific significance to the date of August 27th, relevant and relative to his rantings and ravings, from what I can see anyhow. So very, very, very big lift to try to identify, first detect, identify, and then to mitigate. Super tricky.
Yeah. And then the church, I think, looms large. They see it. It's a part of their past, in the case of this guy. And like your Park Avenue shooter, who was convinced he had, you know, been an NFL player. I mean, these are loners who are just, turning this stuff over in their minds, and it's insanity. But it takes on
exactly
a larger
right.
reality for them, which shows the power of thinking, a thought, repeated and ruminated on long enough. It creates its own reality.
I could not agree more, Raymond. The fact is, this knucklehead up at 345 Park Avenue. And I went down to the crime scene the next morning, and I walked it, and I taped it with a tape measure, and it was 11 seconds and 28 feet. And I did it deliberately to see how long it took from his parked vehicle, the BMW, to get to the doors, because we had provided protection at that building a few years back. So I agree. These seeds, they germinate in the heads of these twisted individuals. And that's where the warning signs and the danger signs are trapped. They don't share it. It's all within the contained within their head. And it becomes gigantic. By the end, it goes from a sapling, in my view, to a redwood. And then they go operational. And it's just no rhyme or reason. There's no prediction element to it. There's no predictive element to it from what I can see and what I read and what I've experienced. And that's exactly right. It ruminates, it festers, and boom. They're just, you know what they are? They're nuts. They're nuts. Yeah. There's a nuttiness
Patrick
to it.
Brosnan.
I mean, think about it. It's nuttiness.
Well, Patrick, I thank you for your time, for your insight. We will stay in touch
pleasure.
With you in the days ahead. Thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure. All the
thank
best.
Thank you so much. The shooting at Annunciation Catholic Church in Minneapolis has obviously broken the nation's heart, as you just heard. Here with insight and analysis on this story and the ongoing battle over the liturgy and more, the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. I wanted to get your take on the spiritual nature of what happened this week in Minneapolis. This 23-year-old killer, who was a male, who identified as female, shot these innocent children through the windows of the parish church there in Minneapolis. Archbishop Bernard Hedba, the archbishop-led priest in a rosary on Wednesday morning following the shooting. Meanwhile, the mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey, had this to say.
Don't just say this is about thoughts and prayers right now. These kids were literally praying.
Father, your thoughts on Mayor Frey's comments following this tragedy?
Yeah, they were a little out of place, to say the least. We don't try to downplay the reaction people have is to think and pray after a horrific, diabolical incident like this. And that really is what needs to be highlighted here. This man, claiming to be a woman, was in fact doing something horrifically diabolical. He was directly opposing God and Christ and the church. He rejoiced in killing innocent people. He tried to prevent them from getting out of the building so he could kill more of them. This is diabolical. This is reminiscent of, you know, the horrific horrors that the Nazis did in the Second World War. This is horrific.
Yeah. Bob, high on the list of concerns for Mayor Frey after these horrific events was this, quote, "I've heard about a whole lot of hate that's being directed at our trans community. Anybody who's using this as an opportunity to villainize our trans community or any other community out there has lost their sense of common humanity. Kids died. This needs to be about them." Bob, no one wants certainly an atmosphere of hate in the wake of tragedy. But your reaction to these comments, it seemed to be an attempt to stifle discussion of the shooter's background and what might have been going on in his mind.
Yeah, he's a deeply, deeply troubled man. He changes to being a woman. And then, as we're reading in the news these days, he actually said recently he's tired of being trans. And he was working before this happened for several months in some marijuana dispensary. So if you read the actual things he wrote, which sometimes, are, by the way, are written in Russian characters, it's a hodgepodge of all sorts of stuff. He's a very confused, and I think Father is rightly to say there's a kind of a diabolical element in this. But look, it starts with the question of, is it true or is it not true that people who think they are trans are disturbed? We've had four major school shootings in recent years, two by trans people, when trans is an infinitesimal part of our population. So, look, we don't want to demonize anyone, but we do need to be realistic and truthful about the fact that a person who thinks that by simply declaring themselves to be a different gender are that gender. This is magical thinking. That kind of person is deeply disturbed. And it's not surprising that a relatively high number of people who are carrying out these things are trans. So look, he's trying to divert the problem away from looking at that truth and put it into a political lens, when in fact that is inescapably part of what this story is about.
Yeah. Given the troubled nature, father of this shooter, shouldn't the role of mental illness be a focus here? And certainly whatever medications he was on, in addition to the marijuana that Bob mentioned. I mean, he worked at this dispensary.
Yeah, this is Bob has hit the, on the target, and thank you for bringing up mental health. People who think they're a different sex than the one they are suffering a mental health problem. They are sadly misled in thinking that God made them the wrong sex. They say, I'm a man in a woman's body. This is ridiculous. We call this a, you know, disorientation or an alienation from yourself. And really, the word alienation should come here into the whole discussion. People alienated from what they are then become alienated from other people and from the world around them, from the law of God. If you read what this man wrote, he's mocking God. He had target pictures set up with Jesus Christ at the in the head. This man was completely disconnected, morally speaking, from the commandment that we have to love our neighbor. He's an evil, evil man doing evil things. And we shouldn't go around tiptoeing saying, well, since he was trans, he was a victim, and therefore he's somewhat justified in lashing out at society. This is nonsense. People who peddle that are doing a disservice. Mental health help should have been given to this man so he can get out of it. But instead, sad to say, his mother went to a court to have his name legally changed. Yeah. That is magical thinking.
Yeah, well, I mean, the New York Times today, I'm going to read the headline. Minneapolis suspect knew her target, Bob, but motive is a mystery. I mean, they're confirming the mental illness in some ways, the disassociation, the alienation that Father mentioned a moment ago. And doesn't this call to mind that Nashville shooter who killed those seven innocent children who was also transitioning?
Yeah, I was about to say that exactly myself. I mean, this isn't simply a mass shooting. This is a mass shooting of children in a church. So if you want to just look at the truth of this situation, okay, we can say that he may have been mentally disturbed. He was under the influence of drugs. There may have been some demonic influence here. But the mere fact that this is in a church, a children, this is taking the most innocent group in our society and deliberately targeting them. If you read his so-called manifestos, he's obsessed with mass murders. But to specifically choose, and we have those pictures, those hand-drawn pictures that he has of the church, he clearly laid out at that particular church. So we've got a religious element that he introduced. We didn't introduce it. And he's going after these young children because he apparently knew that school very well. So those two things added up. On top of the mental difficulties, we're in the presence of a specific type of evil. This isn't just a mass shooting. It's a mass shooting in a religious and young children's situation.
Yeah. Father, I want to dwell on this for a moment. In that manifesto, and there was a video manifesto that this Robert released, and he showed many disturbing things, including anti-Christian, anti-Semitic messaging. He had written messages on the cart, gun magazines. You know, where is your God? All kinds of dialogues with Satan in his diaries, which are very disturbing. It does focus one on the reality of evil. And speak to that, because this is a baptized Catholic we're talking about, this guy. He went to that school. He's a graduate of the school. His mother was a secretary there. What does that tell us about the nature of evil? And speak to me about at times he seems to be warring with himself in this diary. I don't want to do this, but you have to do it. I don't want to go down this road, but kill, kill, kill.
No, he's play acting. He's trying to make an interesting script for the people are going to read it after he kills himself. The man's a coward. He kills children. He kills himself. He is doing some evil act and is taking it out, criticizing God, authorities, going after Jewish people in his writing. This man is a complete degenerate, morally speaking. And I want to ask, where were his parents and neighbors on this whole thing? I saw one account, neighbors who lived in the same apartment complex didn't see any mental health issues. They were mental health professionals, they identified in the story. So, you know, the fact that he is demonically influenced, set out to commit evil, this is the problem we have in our culture, where we relativize truth and morality and say people choose what's right for them, your truth, your morality. No, evil is determined by God, the natural law. People who violate it have to be taught, don't do that. And so for him to have all of this focus on murderers in the past, people like Adam Lanza up in Connecticut killed all those children. This man is very, very evil, trying to imitate evil people.
Yeah. And I mean, you're right. Where were the parents? I mean, he legally acquired all of this, you know, this arsenal that he brought with him to enact this slaying on these innocent people shooting through the stained glass of that church. Look, there'll be much more to unpack in this story in the days ahead. And we'll stay on it. But I want to move on to some other stories. Parishioners in the Archdiocese of Detroit gathered outside the Cathedral of the Most Blessed Sacrament recently to protest prayerfully Archbishop Edward Weisenberger's suppression of the traditional Latin Mass. In the wake of the Diocese of Charlotte's crackdown, Bob, earlier this year, to that backlash that arose when the bishop there, you know, wanted to shut it down in July, he granted an extension. Could you see something similar happening in Detroit?
Well, look, I don't think that we're going to get a resolution on this until the Pope himself speaks. We've talked about this before, that we're put in this difficult situation that Traditionis Custodes has essentially tried to eliminate the traditional Latin Mass by restricting it to such a degree that it almost has to naturally expire, given that it's so restricted. But clearly, there is a dynamic out there among the people, particularly here in the United States. And I think that that's quite interesting, because we've got an American pope who can't help but be aware of what's going on right now. And now we've got two different places where the local people, without raising any sense of illegitimacy about the papacy or, you know, all the things that we keep hearing about, they're just saying, look, we value this form of worship. This is the thing that we're willing to stand up and say, look, just please be fair toward us, because this is as Benedict said, what was sacred in the past cannot be not sacred in the future. That this was the way that many people prayed for centuries. We find this a nourishing way to be in church on a Sunday morning, and why not allow that group of people to worship in the way that is best for them? If a problem arises, you know, if they begin to clash with their local bishop, well, then that's an obvious difficulty and it needs to be examined. But I think just in general terms, there will be no resolution of this until our pope himself decides to do something about it.
Yeah. Another story, Father, I want your reaction to this. The Archdiocese itself is putting on what they're calling a jazz mass on Sunday, August 31st, according to the Detroit Diocesan website. Come be inspired by gospel and jazz music, which draws upon the people's hearts and spirits. The musical setting for the Holy Mass will honor the culture and history of jazz in Detroit. The event is an example of our Catholic faith bringing richness to all areas of our lives. Now, Father, the Archdiocese will honor the culture and history of jazz in Detroit. But what about the culture and history of the church itself as exemplified in the traditional Latin Mass liturgy?
You raise a great point, Raymond. By the way, when all those churches were built in Detroit, the Latin Mass was being celebrated, the vast majority of them. So the cultural heritage is you build a building for a specific form of worship, and then you ban that form of worship, but you say, now we're going to introduce something different. Jazz masses really don't have a place in the church, because the focus then becomes on the music, not on what's happening. Jazz is not a traditional form for active worship. In fact, you're from New Orleans. Jazz is all about improvisation, and it's all about kind of free form. And I love jazz. Jazz piano is one of my favorite things to listen to, but not at Mass. Mass is about form, bringing people in contact with the invisible. And it's directed, though, by the scriptures and the prayers. So it's not about the musician's genius. It's about how you bring forward the message in the Mass.
Yeah, and jazz is about rhythm and syncopation and, you know, getting everybody moving in that same vibe. That's not what the Mass is about. Mass is about focus on God and the transcendent. And you're right, the improvisatory nature, it's actually conflicting with the nature of the Mass itself and what it should be. But it's always amazing to me. We make room, we create new categories of history and culture over here, and yet we ignore the actual history and culture of the Mass itself. Okay, I got to move on to this. Pope Leo has made significant adjustments to the makeup of the dicastery for clergy this week. He just appointed a number of new members of this dicastery. Now, they oversee priests and clergy worldwide, including Cardinals Tagle, Roche, Grech, who's head of the synodal office, and others. There's also a number of consultors to the dicastery, including two women religious. Bob, then Father, your thoughts on these new cardinal appointments as well as the women religious consultors to this dicastery that deals primarily with priests and deacons and diocesan clergy.
Yeah, I have to say, I was disappointed when I saw that list, because to me, other than the appointment of the two women, which obviously is a further step in this direction of trying to be inclusive, which I think of as a political category rather than a spiritual and an ecclesial category, it's the same old figures, you know, Tagle, Grech, you know, all these people. I guess Bishop Varden from Scandinavia was appointed. He's a very powerful and prayerful type of person. So that was an interesting appointment. But it just seems to me that this doesn't really send out a message of any kind of new energies being brought to that particular dicastery. And we certainly need a lot of renewal. And I think a way of finding some kind of activity of the Spirit in all these offices in the Vatican, which I think have rather been languishing or been off on tangents from the primary mission of the Church, which I think Leo has identified quite rightly is to put Jesus in front of everyone, to energize them in their spiritual lives, and recognize that all the other things that we think that we're concerned with are important, but they're secondary to that one spiritual goal.
Father, your reaction, quickly.
Yes, I was happy because Bishop James Cecchio of Metuchen, New Jersey, was listed on as a member, and he was the former rector of the North American College, so he's a very serious and good man. I was disappointed because I was looking at among the consultors. There are quite a few of them from the Gregorian University, which is run by the Jesuits, and that's fine, but I didn't see names from the Angelicum or the Santa Croce run by Opus Dei, so I'm thinking that the span of experts is favoring one university and leaving out others. I don't like that.
Again, I think everybody expected some big sea change. Maybe this is the Pope of continuity rather than the Pope of, and I mean that in continuity with Pope Francis's reign rather than his predecessors. But we'll see. Look, this is, I think with Pope Leo, what we're seeing is sort of a mixed bag. On the one hand, he is certainly more traditional in the way he appears in his public pronouncements. We're hearing a return to the gospel. On the other hand, the personnel that's being chosen seem to favor the same characters we saw under the reign of Pope Francis. We'll see where this shakes out and who ends up leading these dicasteries, which will tell the tale. That will really tell the tale. Pope Leo's also wading into the Middle East, calling for Israel to stop what he calls the collective punishment and forced displacement of Palestinians from Gaza. Bob, Pope Leo is pleading for an immediate ceasefire, a permanent one, in the region. Now, this occurs in the backdrop of Netanyahu and Israel launching a new military offensive into Gaza. Is that a tall order right now, a ceasefire?
Well, look, it's good to call for peace. It's always good for people to try to seek a way out of a conflictive situation like this in which lots and lots of people are dying. I've said before, I'm basically a supporter of Israel. I think that Israel underwent a horrific attack on October 7 a few years ago. People have kind of done the math on this, and if we had a proportionate attack here in the United States, it would be like 50 or 60,000 Americans being killed or kidnapped on a single day. So it was a tremendous blow to Israel. But at a certain point, the attack on Hamas, I think, begins to become counterproductive, and we're probably at that point. I understand why Israel wants to eliminate Hamas. Is that what's happening right now at this point? And so maybe it's a good thing for Leo to put a little bit of pressure on them. I'm glad that he also mentioned that the hostages ought to be released, because I don't think it's even remotely possible to think about a ceasefire until that dimension of the problem is resolved.
Yeah. No, it's a quagmire. And look, you also can't root out Hamas at the expense of every civilian, and distinguishing between civilians and those who are partial to Hamas, that's a hard thing to do. So, look, I understand all sides here feel aggrieved, and you do have these fledgling Orthodox and Catholic communities there caught in the crossfire in Gaza. And our prayers are certainly with them in this moment. Before I go, Father, Pope Leo's also speaking out to Catholic politicians this week. He addressed a group of French political figures. Leo called on them to strengthen their knowledge of Catholic doctrine, to defend natural law, and oppose what he called party directives. Pope Leo offered the following advice. The first and the only advice that I shall give you is this: unite yourselves ever more closely to Jesus, live from him, and bear witness to him. Father, is natural law over ideology possible in today's politics?
Well, we can always appeal to people say we have to have social justice, for instance, and that becomes a unifying theme in political life. But what is social justice? It's the application of natural law and the role of human conscience to recognize that there's a difference between good and evil, and that we have an obligation to do good and to avoid evil. So, yes, I was very happy with that message. The Pope is right on target. You know, right now we face in the moral realm euthanasia, surrogate motherhood, the creation of gender, this gender ideology, all of these things, which at essence are an attack on man and the natural order. How are we going to combat that? Well, we have to make this broad appeal based on natural law and say citizens of each country have an obligation to conform their laws to what will truly benefit all the citizens, and not simply the interest groups who are promoting these deviant ideologies, as you mentioned, the ideologies which reduce man to simply a bunch of desires that he can satisfy as he sees fit.
Well, we will leave it there, gents. I thank you for the time. And for more commentary from Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray and myself, you can visit the Arroyo Grande channel, and we will continue to pray for all those victims of this terrible Minneapolis school shooting and church shooting, and keep those families in our prayers. Gentlemen, thank you. China continues to explore ways to exert its influence within the United States, and the prospects for peace in Europe between Russia and Ukraine seem increasingly remote. Joining me to discuss all of this, attorney, author, and foreign policy expert Gordon Chang. Gordon, thanks for being here. In recent years, China and the CCP have purchased land in the United States. We've talked about this before. Hundreds of thousands of acres of American farmland have been acquired by shell companies on behalf of Chinese entities. Additionally, the CCP has posed a threat to military bases in the U.S., purchasing land nearby or proximate, attempting to buy these properties. For example, in 2022, a Chinese company purchased 300 acres just 12 miles from the Grand Forks Air Force Base in North Dakota. One U.S. Air Force officer warned that the prospect posed a costly national security risk, and local officials ultimately shut it down. Gordon, what's the latest on this land situation now? I mean, just this week we heard of Chinese investors and companies buying up land in New Hampshire. And we know the well-documented stories of China purchasing farmland in Texas. Why would the government allow this to go on, the U.S. government, and do nothing to reverse some or all of these purchases?
Well, we think we're a society at peace, Raymond, and so therefore we don't impose these restrictions on an enemy. And China calls us an enemy, so we should think of them in the same terms. Now, we know that these Chinese purchases of land, there are a number of reasons for them. You know, at its most innocent level, there are people who just want to live in a free society, and they're buying a place where they can live. But with these large purchases of farmland and ranch land, there are many very suspicious activities going on. So, for instance, there was the Grand Forks Air Force Base issue that you mentioned. And we see that across the country where Chinese parties are buying land near military facilities. But we're also seeing criminal activities on land, especially in places like Oklahoma and Maine. The illegal marijuana grows that bring in the Chinese gangs, that bring in murders. And in Oklahoma, there's also these stories about China basing human trafficking operations on farmland. So there are many things that we need to look at.
Yeah. In some good news, President Trump recently unveiled the National Farm Security Action Plan, which ultimately will defend U.S. farmland and U.S. sovereignty against this encroachment by the CCP. Gordon, this is, I guess it's better late than never, but has the damage already been done?
Well, the damage has been done. And yes, we will need to not only prohibit Chinese purchases of farm and ranch land, but we also need to take back land that the Chinese have already acquired. So this is going to be difficult for us. Some of it's going to require expropriation, which means compensation. But also we should be applying federal forfeiture acts, which allow us to take land that's been used in the commission of a crime and not pay compensation. But ultimately, we know that no American can own land in China, not even a square inch. So why are we allowing the Chinese to own hundreds, thousands of square miles of our farm and ranch land here?
Yeah. It does make you scratch your head. I mean, for years, we didn't do any business with Russia during the Cold War, yet we freely trade and allow China to run roughshod, even buying land purchases in the United States, when they're clearly, as you said earlier, they consider us an enemy. It is mind-boggling. On Monday, Donald Trump said he wants to open denuclearization talks with Russia and China. Speaking to reporters ahead of that meeting with the president of South Korea, Trump said this: "I think the denuclearization is it's a big aim, but Russia is willing to do it, and I think China is going to be willing to do it, too. We can't let nuclear weapons proliferate. We have to stop nuclear weapons. The power is too great." Gordon, your thoughts on the president's remarks there?
Well, these remarks sort of are really a product of his belief that there should be peace in this world. Now, our main arms limitation agreement with Russia expires in February of next year, the New START treaty. And after that, there's nothing. I'm not so sure that we are going to see China actually be open to arms control talks. And matter of fact, the Chinese foreign ministry yesterday said it wouldn't talk with us about it. And that is consistent with China's posture on arms control discussions, which we have seen over the last several years. They just will not talk to us about it. And there's a lot of reasons why for their position.
U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff said on Tuesday that he will meet with representatives from Ukraine in New York, while saying that Washington continues to talk to Russia. As you know, the president wants to end this battle between Russia and Ukraine. But Russia is pushing deeper into Ukrainian territory. Do you see an end to this conflict? And was that summit with Putin in Alaska kind of a bust?
Well, you know, this is Trump foreign policy, and we won't know whether it was a bust or not until we see the end of the process. But the problem is that Putin is continuing to kill civilians in Ukraine as a matter of deliberate policy, as we see all these attacks on Kyiv and other cities. And this war will only end, I believe, until we cut off all flows of money to Russia. We need to starve the Russian war machine. Until we do that, Putin's going to keep on killing.
Before we go, Gordon, we've covered this story for many years. We had Sebastian Lai on the show last week talking about his father Jimmy Lai's incarceration and trial. Well, this week, the judges in that trial have reached to reach a verdict on these three national security charges that Jimmy faces. That could see the 77-year-old pro-democracy and devout Catholic jailed for life. Based on what you've seen so far, how do you expect these judges to rule?
They're going to find him guilty on all three charges. This is a verdict that is mandated by not only Beijing, but also by John Lee, who's the chief executive of Hong Kong. It's in China's interest, and it's actually in Hong Kong's interest, to get Jimmy out of custody even after a conviction. Because if he dies in custody, he becomes even more of a martyr than he is right now. And that's a problem that Beijing will not be able to solve. So it's in their interest to free him under some sort of medical parole or some humanitarian gesture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was amazed last week when Sebastian Lai said the Vatican hadn't reached out to him and that they weren't. Well, I mean, we hear very little from the Vatican on this Jimmy Lai trial. I mean, this is a Catholic layman, a very prominent one, a convert who is languishing in you know, a Chinese prison, partially because of his faith, which is motivating him to stand up for the freedom of people, not only the freedom of their bodies, but the freedom of their souls and spirits. I'll give you the last word.
Oh, that's absolutely right. The Vatican's posture on this has been shameful, that mirrors some pretty shameful activity. Posture being by London, because remember, Jimmy Lai is a British citizen. And it's great that President right. Trump mentioned Jimmy's case. And I believe that President Trump is going to work to free Jimmy at some point. This is really important for us to keep the pressure on.
You bet. Gordon Chang, thank you, as always, for being here. For the latest reports and analysis from Gordon, you can follow him on X at Gordon G. Chang. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Raymond.
As the liturgy wars reignited by Pope Francis's crackdown on the traditional Latin Mass continues in places like Detroit and Charlotte, North Carolina, how are the Catholic faithful being affected by the Masses suddenly outlawed in their parishes? A new film going viral on YouTube, Bread, Not Stones, captures members of the traditional Latin Mass community in the Diocese of Charlotte reacting to these new bans that kick in October. Here to share his experience as a founding member of the Charlotte Latin Mass community, creator of the Liturgy Guide blog, Brian Williams. Brian, thanks for being here. Pope Francis promulgated these restrictions on the Latin Mass in 2021. He passes away in April. Pope Leo's elected in May. Then not long after that, the new Archbishop of Charlotte, Michael Martin, announces even tighter restrictions on the TLM for Charlotte. He gave that July 8th deadline. And then, as you remember, there was a backlash, and it extended to October 2nd. Around the same time, similar actions were declared by the Archbishop of Detroit. What was the reaction of the folks in Charlotte when they heard that the bishop would be further restricting this celebration of the traditional ancient Mass? And was there prior division in the diocese regarding the traditional Latin Mass?
So, no, the restrictions have been announced under the prior bishop because Rome was demanding something to be shown that Traditionis Custodis was being implemented here. I think it was a bit of a punt down the road and then to see what would happen in October of this year. And because the prior bishop, Bishop Peter Jugas, was very friendly to tradition and had always supported the traditional liturgy. Bishop Martin came in and decided to move that forward, as you said, to July. And then I think only because of the backlash received, reinstituted the prior deadline in October, which first moving it up was disturbed the faithful very much. And then, of course, as time moved along, showing that we did not have any type of division or disunity within the community. And I'm not going to say that everything has always been perfect. We've had this Mass every Sunday since 2012. We've had the Latin Mass being offered in parishes since 2007, really with the beginning with Summorum Pontificum. But really the unity right. was there. And what's interesting was people not only going back and forth between the two Masses, but even those who settled into the traditional Mass only or the Novus Ordo only knew each other. Co-ops for homeschooling mm-hmm. communities, different activities. Some of the boys serve both the Masses. So it kind of mm-hmm. was the model that I think that Benedict wanted to see. It's what we achieved. It's what the pastors themselves and the faithful told Bishop Martin since he was new to the diocese. Now, mind you, not in person because he's never come to visit our community. So we've never met with him. But we've told him that through petitions mm-hmm. and online and through our pastors. And none of that has seemed to persuade him to ask for any kind of further dispensation.
Yeah, I want to talk for a moment about this film in which you're featured and you're acting as a spokesman, Bread, Not Stones. Brian, how did this project come about? And what is its purpose? Sean O'Halloran, who's the director, and his colleague started production in June. The film is now posted on Regina Magazine's website and their YouTube channel. Give me a sense of where this came from.
So Regina Magazine wanted to really chronicle what was happening because we've seen these great videos online. Mass of the Ages comes to mind. That really kind of give you the macro of the story. But what happens when a particular diocese first discovers the traditional Mass, and then what happens when they're faced with losing it? And that's what Regina wanted to capture. And reaching out to Sean O'Halloran, his wife Tracy, who conducted the interviews. These are people who used to attend Mass, who actually drove from South Carolina just to come to St. Anne's in Charlotte for the Latin Mass until they got their own down there. So they know the community well, but it happens that they're phenomenal filmmakers too. So Regina was able to match up with the O'Hallorans, and this vision came to fruition then. And I think it's a fantastic film.
Yeah. I want to give people a taste of what they'll be seeing. This is a bit of Bread, Not Stones, where Charlotte Catholics react to the new restrictions on the Latin Mass. As Brian mentioned, the first part of the film is really about people who are just discovering it for the first time, what they receive there that's different from their previous experience, and then the restrictions kick in. Watch this.
When the whole thing in Charlotte happened, my first thought was, and Matthew and I have talked about that in the past, is what good father gives their children stoned when they're asking for bread, or what good father reaches them a serpent when they're asking for fish. If my children came to me and said, Mama, I'm hungry, I'm not going to go tell them, go outside and eat a rock.
That being said, it's still hard because as a pastor, you want to see your people, and Sunday is when you see your people. And there will be a hole here in our community.
To bounce back and forth just for us in the way that our family is structured would have been really, really difficult. We kind of had to decide where we were gonna be. There's a little bit of liturgical schizophrenia when you're trying to do both. If the Mass goes away, it will be really, really sad. Mm-hmm. For our family, and we know for other people as well. Mm-hmm. It will be very, very disruptive.
The thing that is the hardest for me is a big part of my faith life is it's a journey, right? And we're not supposed to be doing this journey on our own. We should be doing it within our parish. And now we're going to be living this double life where we worship with a group of people and then we come back to our parish for other needs. So it's going to be a little schizophrenic.
Say, okay, this is what it looks like to trust God, you know, and even when things go wrong, especially when things go wrong, you already have these graces and you already have this community that knows how to do this, that knows how to navigate this.
If the Latin Mass was to go away from St. Anne's, it would be super divisive. And I know you know this, but it would be the worst thing that anybody could do is to push away part of the parish family. It would be like causing a divorce. And it would be like a forced divorce within this parish. This liturgy has uplifted so many people, including me. And if it wasn't for the Latin Mass, I wouldn't be who I am today.
With your blog, The Liturgy Guy, Brian, you actually conducted surveys of Latin Mass goers a few years ago. Tell me about the support from non-Latin Mass goers in the Diocese of Charlotte. How significant was that? And has the diocese tried to imply that this kind of support doesn't exist at all?
The diocese has used the language of division and discord and seeking to address that. Mm. The problem with that narrative is, number one, the pastors themselves, who you would think would want to have peace in their parish, have said that there is peace in their parish currently, and that the disunity will come from exiling parishioners. There's a clip in the film where Father Timothy Reed says, asking someone to have to choose between the mass they love and the parish they love, it's an unfair position you're putting somebody in. Within the diocese itself, many, and I believe it was more than half of the letters that were sent to the bishop, the petition that was generated asking him to reconsider, were from folks who don't go to the Latin Mass. In many cases, maybe they only go on a certain vigil or certain feast days or whatever, but these are people who know each other, who are close to each other. As I said, it's a large homeschooling community. It's a large Catholic community. And when you're in the parish such as St. Anne's or St. Thomas Aquinas, the faithful who go to the ordinary form know the people who go to the Latin Mass and vice versa and get along well and see each other outside of Mass.
Well, this is the mutual enrichment that Pope Benedict talked about, that you'd get, you know, bleed over from one Mass, the extraordinary form, to the ordinary form and vice versa. And that created a fulsome community. The challenge here, as you mentioned, they're asking people to go now to a remote location. They're going to have a Mass at a former Protestant church, only one Latin Mass in the entire diocese, which is going to kick in October 2nd. So the four parishes that currently offer it, all those people will have to go to that central Mass. And then they're still saying, but we want you involved in parish life. I don't understand how that's possible, Brian. You're asking people to basically separate the worship that they are adherents of from the parish life that they were once a part of, but they're expelled. They can't worship in that parish any longer. How does that make sense?
It doesn't. It is not. The impression is that it is not set up for success. There were some documents that were leaked a few months ago when it kind of all first came to a head, and the Q&A or the talking points released that were attributed to Bishop Martin point to the very fact that many will not be able to continue going to this Mass when it gets moved. And it implied that that's okay. It's implied that if they cannot go, then more or less mission accomplished, which is very heartless considering that there are so many of these young people who have grown up going to this Mass, their friends are in their parish. Some are going to make the drive, but there are many who can't. Financially, they can't do that, pay for that gas. They can't make that 2-hour drive one way in some instances. And so it's not with the pastor's heart, it would seem, that you're doing that. It seems to be more of an agenda as opposed to a response to anything that anyone is asking for. And again, the film points to this. It points to the very articulate faithful telling the story. And it's a sad story, ultimately, at the end, unless, God willing, something changes here at the end.
No. Well, you could have called it the Henry VIII effect. I mean, you're basically outlawing something overnight. And it's so dislocative to people. It's so rupturing to their family lives and their faith lives, particularly if you want to root them in a parish at a time when you're looking to strengthen and grow parishes, I imagine. But what effect do you hope this film will have on those who see it, lay people as well as priests and maybe the bishop himself, particularly Pope Leo?
I think a couple of things. There are individuals who I think still kind of adhere to the stereotype, or all they know is the stereotype that the people who go to the Latin Mass are disruptive or you know, just not pleasant. What you see with this are these are folks who are very knowledgeable, they're very charitable, and they really are just looking to go to Mass and they want to be part of their parish. So I hope it humanizes this community. Because it's a reflection of other communities as well that have already been impacted and may still be impacted. With regards to Pope Leo, we've been told unofficially that that's where it's going to have to come from. If we're going to get any kind of relief from this situation, it's going to have to come from Rome. And so we would hope that, you know, an American pope and that you can see that there's no charity in this process. This is not for the betterment of the church. It's not for the betterment of these parishes. It's going to be something that really hurts families deeply. And you're talking about folks who just want to live their faith and just want to go to Mass. And they're there all through the week, not just on Sundays, very involved in their parishes.
Brian Williams, we will leave it there. You can find the film Bread Not Stones at Regina Magazine's website. They're at reginamagazine.org or on their YouTube channel. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you, Raymond.
That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. In the meantime, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.